If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hang on to your jewellery, it's time for another flat chat. Perhaps you're quietly amused by the fact that the debate over Lewis Hamilton's piercings continue to rage as Formula One reached a country ruled by a Prince Albert. Perhaps you don't want to hear about the subject ever again. Fear not, our new columnist Maurice Hamilton has the last word on it in the latest issue of GP Racing magazine. You might even have read this column already because we're a week or two late recording this month's podcast, thanks to the aforementioned Monaco Grand Prix, an Airbnb with commodious though it was, terrible Wi-Fi, and the small business of the UK shutting down for the Diamond Jubilee, and hopefully still enjoying an element of jubilation, are my guests. Welcome our soon to be departing the country, fingers crossed if that plane's not cancelled, Mark Gallagher.
Very nice to be with you, even though we're a bit late, but I enjoyed a trip to Monaco as well, so it was nice that you were there too, Cotters.
We were like super yachts passing, weren't we? You were hobnobbing with the big cheeses.
Yeah, I was actually on the super yacht, so that is the major difference, really.
I love it that they make you take your shoes off.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. There was one particular event that I went to with the aforementioned Prince Albert, as you do, and even he was asked to take his shoes off as we got on board the yacht. So there you go. It applies to everyone.
Did he have a shoe wrangler or a shoe flunky to?
No, actually, I found him. He was pretty self-contained. He didn't have a big entourage around him, and interestingly, and perhaps very topically, the other person who was chatting with Prince Albert was Greg Maffei, the chief executive of Liberty Media, owners of F1. I think the conversation was something to do with, would you like the Monaco Grand Prix to continue?
Awkward!
Yeah, yeah. Sharpen those pencils.
Yeah, exactly. And I have a photograph of them together. So, I can sell that to the magazine for a substantial sum.
Hold on a second.
Good luck with that.
Alternatively, I might just post it on Twitter for free and just be done with it and say, here's the head of the principality and the head of Formula One's owner in deep conversation. But anyway, it was a very nice evening. But yes, everyone had to take the shoes off, and it was all part of the wonderful Monaco yacht experience.
Do you know, our principal photographer, Stephen T, says there's two great things about the super yacht stroke Monaco harbour experience. One, getting on the boat. Two, deciding that you hate it and you get off again.
But I'm surprised. I would have thought Stephen T would like the super yacht experience.
But the thing that's remarkable about super yacht experiences is that no one ever sits down. Everyone gets on board, walks around the outer deck taking photographs of where they are in Monaco, and then runs out of things to do. And everything is so pristine, no one is prepared to slump in a chair. So as a result, the deep piled carpet and the beautiful lounge suite remains untouched by human hand.
Well, I suppose people not being allowed to wear their shoes, they get to enjoy the feeling of standing up with no shoes on and the comfort of their socks or bare feet. So, this is a strange experience when you're in a Formula One paddock.
Well, it's absolute murder, I imagine, for sufferers of plantar fasciitis. So, I'd ask for a special exemption for me to at least wear my UFOS recovery sliders. And anyway, welcome, Ben Anderson.
Thank you. Yeah, I broke the podcast rule of speaking before being interrupted.
Yeah, you interrupted before you were introduced. How dare you?
So, yes. I apologise, but you can introduce me now.
Yeah, hello, welcome, Ben Anderson.
Thank you, yes. I always feel jubilant speaking to you on this podcast, Codders.
As we speak, Max Verstappen versus Lewis Hamilton is so last year. Charles and Max were fighting each other for karting championships. They then got out of sync in single-seaters and didn't really meet. When they did get to Formula One, they were slightly out of sync in terms of competitive machinery. Now the battle's on again. So we have Verstappen versus Leclerc, Red Bull versus Ferrari. How tasty do we think it's going to get, Ben?
I think it could get quite tasty. It's all a bit, you know, cordial and friendly at the moment, isn't it, compared to what we saw last year with Red Bull, Mercedes, Christian Horner, Toto Wolff, Max and Lewis. Horner's been talking about how, you know, Max and Charles have this, you know, history that you mentioned going back to karting. You know, they're of the same generation, so they've got a different level of respect, and maybe, you know, Max and Lewis don't share that in quite the same way. But, you know, it's all very well being friendly at the start. You know, Ferrari are probably basking in the, you know, the relief of having spent the last 2 years wisely and returned to the front. Finally, they've got a competitive car again. So, you know, there's a bit of a buzz probably from that. And there's not quite the same level of off-track rancour yet either. You cover this quite well in your feature, Codders.
I'll give myself a pat on the back.
Yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned that it's building perhaps with, you know, already some, you know, pre-accusations flying around the cost cap, and, you know, Binotto asking the question of how Red Bull can update their car almost every race, and surely at this rate they're going to run out of money to spend, or they're going to bust the cap, and that's going to mean, you know, well, we don't know what it means, do we? That's the thing. It's an untested regulation. So does it mean points deduction if you go over? Does it mean a slap on the wrist? Does it mean a, you know, ironically a fine when you're supposed to be spending less money, not more? We don't know. But then, of course, you know, with inflation running rampant, now there's bigger fish to fry. They can't really afford to go at each other because they're both in a situation where they need to, you know, basically plead with Formula One to grant them exemption so that they can, in Horner's words, afford to make the final races of the season. So there's, you know, probably the backdrop is that they're more relied at the moment on the bigger issues than Mercedes and Red Bull were at the end of last year, where it was just, you know, gloves off, you know, the Merc machine creaking towards the end of it, the previous concept on its car, and, you know, needing to, you know, find other ways to kind of peg Red Bull back, who were going all out with Honda in the final year of Honda's participation to win the championship. And yeah, Max and Lewis, different personalities, different drivers, you know, different approaches to racing. Max is, well, we've seen, you know, no one needs the history lesson. He's a hard charger, a guy who pushes the boundaries at every opportunity. The rulemakers have had to rein him in a few times and adjust the codes of conduct to try and get control of, you know, on-track etiquette, and that reared its head again last year, didn't it? You know, with you know, what constitutes pushing another driver off track, etc. And I think that's probably the main difference between Verstappen and Leclerc. I think probably on pure driving, you know, speed, there's not much in it. You know, they're both outstanding guys, you know, capable of, you know, magical qualifying performances. And, you know, where did that come from? Laps. But I think perhaps on the sort of racecraft and the absolute killer instinct to go for any gap and ask those questions and take the consequences, Max is probably slightly ahead. That's partly, I think, a consequence of him being in a top team and at the front of Formula One for longer. But maybe not. You know, he was pushing the boundaries basically as soon as he got into Red Bull. It's not like he's waited, you know, felt the rest of the championship out and then gone for it. Whereas I feel like Leclerc, you know, he's maybe not quite so cutthroat or aggressive as Max. I'm not saying he's less determined to win and be champion. You know, all these guys have got a hard edge. But it's interesting to me that when they finally came together on track, this was, what, 3 years ago, 2019 Austrian Grand Prix, I think, Leclerc had a chance to win that race. And Verstappen kind of elbowed him aside to win at the hairpin towards the end of the race. And Leclerc kind of felt that he'd been bullied and that Max had got away with one. And then the next race, they came together, Silverstone. He won a wheel-to-wheel fight and he was much more aggressive. So it shows that he can do it, but I think he's a bit more of a follower in terms of, you know, where's the line? How aggressive am I going to be? Whereas Max is kind of a bit more of a trendsetter, if you like, in that regard. And so I wonder if when it comes to the absolute crunch, at the moment it's all nicey-nicey and, you know, the cars are very closely matched but in very different... they have very, very different performance envelopes. You know, it looks like the Ferrari is a very, very fast qualifying car, a bit more downforce, especially at low and medium speed. The Red Bull, a slipperier car, faster at high speed, a bit more challenging to drive at low speed. So they kind of swing a bit. You know, qualifying's not so close. Max is maybe doing, you know, a stellar job to get amongst it. And then the races tend to come to the Red Bull a bit more. And they haven't really had any races yet where you feel like they're completely evenly matched when they're on track together. So therefore, it's a bit, you know, easier to be sanguine in defeat. Leclerc can say, well, you know, if he's in my DRS zone, what am I going to do? I can't, you know, can't really fight him off. You know, equally, Max knows if he can get in range in a race, he's pretty much got the job done. You know, so Leclerc's only option is to do what he's been doing, qualify and pole and try and disappear into the distance. And a few times that's worked. Melbourne, it worked very well. Barcelona, it was working well until the engine let go. So that, I don't think they've had those kind of really tough, you know, infinitesimal gap battles that, you know, can seesaw one way or the other, depending on who's a bit too aggressive, like Lewis and Max had several times last year. So it'd be interesting to see as the championship develops, if they stay close and the development war doesn't take one of Ferrari or Red Bull away from the other, whether it gets a bit more needly, because I feel like Max has been in that situation and he knows how to push the boundaries and handle it, and Leclerc hasn't maybe quite had to do that so much yet.
Yeah, really interesting feature, Colors. I mean, the point that comes up around the budget cap is so fascinating, because this is going to be a factor through the year, and there'll be different points of the season when the budget cap really becomes discussed. And obviously you mentioned the increased, for example, increased energy costs. I can't imagine what the energy bill for a wind tunnel is. You know, the cost cap is going to be interesting, because what you can see happening is that, you know, Red Bull are developing quite nicely, literally developing the car quite nicely. At some point, they'll have to stop doing that. What then happens will be interesting. So you wonder if Red Bull have decided to front-load the season with development. Have Ferrari decided to take a slightly more even upward, you know, glide path, as it were? And are we going to see that coming? And you could see a situation, you know, get to the middle of the season and, you know, Red Bull are comfortably leading the championship, but unfortunately have to really pull back on further development to stay within the budget cap. And then Ferrari turn up in Monza with their planned big upgrade, you know, because for Monza or something. And then suddenly you have a very unhappy Max Verstappen, because he's realizing the team have, you know, both hands tied behind their back because of the budget cap, and he can't get more bits, more speed, more performance. Whereas if Charles is able to maintain a development curve with Ferrari, because, you know, they've spread their budget more appropriately, and Mattia Binotto says in your feature, you know, he's not quite sure how Red Bull can keep on this level of expenditure. And we know Christian Horner himself has gone public in terms of saying we need to do something about the budget cap. So the budget cap, as you know, the third suite of regulations, is very much now the focus of so much day-to-day attention in the teams. Highly problematic for Mercedes-Benz as they continue to try and dig themselves out of the hole which they found themselves in with the new regulations and the new car. But in the case of Red Bull and Ferrari, that needle match, and as you say, Ben, it's been quite even. Although I have to say, I came away from Monaco thinking, you know, obviously Sergio won the race, Max third, but
Ferrari messing it up, aren't they? They're messing it up.
I just came away thinking, wow, you know, the momentum is with Red Bull, and you know, we've seen, you know, we've seen Charles make errors, we've seen Ferrari make errors. You can't make errors, you know, at any level, not in the cockpit, not in the pit wall, not in the strategy room back at headquarters. And
well, the two most recent races, as we record, Barcelona and Monaco, Ferrari had the fastest car. They had pole position for both races. The front row lockout in Monaco, thanks to Perez, largely. And they didn't win either race. And, OK, they were, you know, there was some misfortune in Barcelona, but nevertheless, reliability, that falls on the team, doesn't it? And they threw away the Monaco Grand Prix, although it was a challenging one to manage. And you can't afford to do that, knowing how good Red Bull are. You know, the budget cap, you know, strangeness allowing, you know, they're a great team at development. We know this, and they've proven it time and again. Ferrari, actually not. It'd be really interesting to see if Binotto's kind of got that part of the ship righted, because when they previously had a chance at the championship, they ran out of steam in the second part of the season. You know, Monza was kind of the point at which it tended to dip, and Mercedes would and Hamilton would come on strong and seal the deal. I feel like Ferrari need to make the most of the fact they've started the year with an advantage, with the fastest car, probably because of the fact they wrote off the 2 years previous, really. And they haven't maximised it. You know, they've thrown points away. And Red Bull actually have won more races than they should have done. And I'd be quite worried about that unless Ferrari have the perfect plan around the budget cap and development, and they can continue to improve the car in a way that Red Bull can't afford to. That might actually save them.
Yeah, and I think the other interesting dynamic is that we know Max can get quite ratty if things aren't going his way. Obviously, they have been going his way, Monaco accepted. But that kind of leads me to my point, because then in the wake of the Monaco result, you have his father, Jos, you know, giving an interview in which he's talking about the fact that Red Bull should have still engineered, you know, a better result for Max in the race ahead of Perez, and you can't afford, you know, basically saying we can't afford for Perez to win a race. Max needs to be allowed to do that. Now, so you've got Jos, and you can't blame him as a father for being passionate about, you know, wanting to achieve, you know, the best outcome for his son. But motor racing fathers, as we've talked about before, are not that helpful in a team situation.
You know, diplomatically put, Mark.
and you know, you would, I mean, if I was running an F1 team, I would have it in the driver's contract that their parents aren't allowed to give media interviews and to express. I mean, it's just not helpful, because it throws another dimension into the whole formula for the team's kind of.
I'd
well,
be very unhappy with that clause. You know, I had much joy interviewing Jos and Carlos Sainz Sr.
Yeah.
when their two sons were coming up the ranks. So I'd be very unhappy if that was the way.
We don't really want any Wittgenstein clauses as journalists, do we? Where off one cannot speak, there off one must remain silent. No, but
can you imagine, Ben, coming into the office and discovering that, you know, one of your parents has given an interview to your boss, you know, about, you know, what they think of you know, how you're being treated or something. I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous. So, the point I was going to make is Max, you know, has this father who's quite outspoken. You have this sense that the hunger which Max has to win, and I think, you know, I'm always fascinated by what happens to that hunger. How does that get channeled into you know, driving the best possible outcomes? It can tip over into being anger, and you know, and this is where things could go wrong, because you could imagine this. It's not difficult to imagine the scenario where, again, as the season progresses, if, you know, Max finds himself in an uncomfortably close battle for the championship with Charles through the balance of the season, there will be these other factors. You know, there will be pressure from within the team, from within the family. You know, Jos making statements, Helmut Marko making statements. The needle will increase. They'll have a. They'll start saying publicly things to try and destabilise Ferrari. So that you just get the feeling that there could be a degree of unsettled behaviour, perhaps come more from the Verstappen camp than from the Leclerc camp. I think what you said, you know, is really interesting. You know, Calder, also about, you know, the way in which these two guys have a very different mindset. You know, you have the impression that yes, Charles definitely does have the. I mean, he has the speed, as you say, Ben. It absolutely, unquestionably has the speed. You're probably right in that maybe he needs to see who else does what in terms of what limit is acceptable, where are we prepared to take it. You also have the impression that, you know, the pressure of being at Ferrari might sometimes be a factor, and it's always a factor for people at Ferrari. Going back to talking about the sort of race strategy decisions and the way in which they've, you know, effectively, you know, thrown away victories already this year. One of the things which I've found really interesting is to talk to people who've worked at Ferrari, you know, I'm talking about quite senior people, who will say to you, there's nothing that prepares you for the pressure that working at Ferrari brings. That, you know, if you've worked in a British team, experienced, you know, winning Grand Prix, going for the championship at a British team, you then go to Ferrari and you find this layer of pressure across the whole organisation. It comes from everywhere. It comes from the owners of Ferrari, comes from the media, the Italian media, comes from the fan base, actually comes from within. You know, you're at Ferrari and you feel this intense obligation to push on and make Ferrari the greatest team in Formula One. I think that brings with it a lot of pressure.
But that's where Binotto comes in, right? That's, I think, part of his work has been to become the shield, if you like. You know, he seems to have bought the Ferrari ownership, the media, the fan base kind of on board with what he's doing, and he seems to be trying to diffuse that internal pressure and be the guy who kind of, like a sponge, absorbs all that moisture, if you like, and tries to stop it from seeping into the factory and into the mindsets of all of his people.
It's a massive challenge for one man to take on. And, you know, he's an engineer and he's ended up in the top job. And, you know, we were talking, before we pressed the record button about people who get promoted to a level beyond their competence. It's I think it's called the Peter Principle in business, you know, where people just get promoted up the hierarchy until they reach a level that they're actually not qualified to do. But the reality is that, you know, he's risen into that role. He's a very different type of team principal from a Toto Wolff or a Christian Horner. It's another really interesting dynamic between those teams, really quite different leaders involved. And so for the Ferrari Red Bull, you know, battle, it's, you know, it's Mattia versus Christian. It's Ferrari's way of doing things versus Red Bull's way of doing things in those development cycles that you talked about. And then, yes, Charles and Max, quite different beasts. You know, there's the one commonality is they're very fast racing drivers, you know, at the top of their game. And I love Cotter's, the fact that, you know, if you go back, I mean, it's only 10 years, but you go back to 2012 and they're both in karting. And, it's extraordinary to then think what's happened in the few years since. And in fact, the point you make very well is just how quickly Max went from karting to Formula One. And Charles had a slightly longer route, you know, to get up there. But here they are again, head to head. And yeah, but I definitely, my own view is that having seen what happened, certainly in Monaco, Ferrari and Charles can't afford more weekends like that. Max and Red Bull will just absolutely punish them. And let's face it, Sergio Perez was protected from team orders in Monaco by the presence of Carlos Sainz running in second place. And I mean, we could all feel that during the race. I think it was, you know, people were debating afterwards, would they have asked Sergio to move over if Max was running second? Absolutely no question about it. I mean, absolutely no question. They would have done it. It would have been even harder on Sergio than what happened in Barcelona. But they would ask him. And, you know, Sergio's in that kind of Valtteri Bottas position of the win will come to him when circumstances allow that. And he will win his, you know, 1, 2, 3 Grand Prix a year, whatever. Great to see him retained in the team. Why has he been retained in the team? He's been retained in the team because he plays the perfect supporting role to Max, even though, you know, he was grumpy after Barcelona. The reality is, you know, Sergio has a big enough view of the sport now after this length of time to know that being the number two driver at Red Bull Racing isn't a bad place to be. Perhaps
I think that's where he's slightly different from Bottas, if I may cut in, because I think Bottas learned that the hard way.
Yes, you're right, 100%.
It was never explicit, and he certainly went in with the mindset of I'm going to beat Lewis and I'm going to become world champion. And you saw the circumstances over time chip away at him gradually as he realised it wasn't doable. But he never wanted or willingly played the dutiful number two, whereas I think at Red Bull it's a little bit more explicit, or at least the implication is more obvious. And so this Perez might be occasionally grumpy like he was after Barcelona, but he knows, you know, that he's there to back up. And like you said, because he's had so much of a career before and it didn't look like he was ever going to get another chance at a top team, he's just making hay while the sun shines, doesn't he? And like you say, the occasional win, regular podiums is great for him.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, 18 months ago, Perez didn't have a Formula One drive. You know, he was heading down the path to, you know, ex-F1 driverdom.
And yeah, IndyCar or whatever, yeah, you know, fancy doing, yeah.
And here we are, 18 months in, he's just come out of winning the Monaco Grand Prix, he's had a contract extended for 2 years. I mean, he's in a happy place. And on this very point, really important point, I agree with you 100%. Valtteri went into Mercedes off the back of very good performances at Williams. And
yeah. Well, Ferrari wanted him at one stage, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, really, and he went in there and then learned the hard way, the number two role. And now, you know, quite unashamedly, he's happy to say in interviews, I couldn't beat Lewis consistently. I could beat Lewis on my very best day, but I couldn't have those very best days all the time. I wasn't consistent enough. And
we had his David Coulthard moment, didn't he? It was exactly the same for DC against Hakkinen. Yeah. You know, I can do it, but I can't do it regularly enough. And that's
so, and then, you know, I know we probably, you know, we don't have it in the script for the magazine's contents this month. But I mean, if you then look at the Daniel Ricciardo situation, you go back and you think to yourself, well, someone really needed to sit down with Daniel back in, you know, his Red Bull, you know, moment of decision.
And 2018, wasn't it?
And say to Daniel, listen, there are a lot worse things in the world than to be the number two driver at Red Bull. And you know what? Even if the team is built around Max and it's moving that way, you will win more Grand Prix. And by the way, there will be plenty of occasions when you will have the beating of him. So just keep in there. But instead, you know, it was described to me by a fellow F1 driver as Daniel decided to cash in. You know, he cashed in his chips, went to Renault, take the money, then turns up at McLaren, and is number two driver at McLaren now to Lando Norris. I mean, it's true.
He should have stayed at Renault, shouldn't he, really? Because things were building quite nicely there. Ocon was taking time to find his feet. The car was gravitating to what Daniel likes. And he's gone to McLaren, who've built quite an esoteric car, I think, in the last few years. And it has traits that persist that are quite challenging. And Norris just turns out to be a mega, doesn't he? You know, he's in that group with Verstappen, Leclerc and George Russell. Like, they are the future heavyweights of Formula One, if you like. And maybe when Ricciardo made his decision to go to McLaren, it wasn't quite clear that Lando would make that leap. And I felt like McLaren kind of felt like, if we get Ricciardo in, that's a good benchmark. We'll actually know for sure, you know, where Lando sits, because Ricciardo was a proven Grand Prix winner, not far off Verstappen when Verstappen and he were together at Red Bull, whereas Sainz was kind of still coming up, if you like, and it was close between Norris and Sainz, but with Sainz you never knew quite, you know, what the benchmark was, and now it looks like, well, actually, Norris is quite outstanding, and science is a lot better than people think. And Ricciardo's now facing this challenge of how do you maintain your reputation as one of the best when, you know, you're basically having your ass handed to you every week. It's very difficult.
Yeah. It's very difficult. And I mean, it's not much of a consolation for McLaren to be able to say to Daniel, oh, thanks so much for turning up and proving just how good Lando is.
But there must be something in the car, you know, because Ricciardo really struggled when he went to Renault initially, and then they made that breakthrough at Silverstone. I think it was the anniversary Grand Prix in the first year of the pandemic,
and
a few setup tweaks, and then suddenly he was getting this sensation of rear grip that he really depends on. You know, it's like there's many drivers who, you know, like that particular characteristic, and then they managed to kind of build on that for 2021, and he was outstanding that year, I thought, you know, taking Renault back to the podium and everything. But of course, by that stage, he's made a decision to, you know, to leave. But he's gone into a place where, you know, I think McLaren's car, I'm not sure it's how they want it, but it's just, you know,
it's
how it is. It's just much peakier and I think much more on the nose and just not, you know, obviously, you know, we're talking about, you know, very fine threshold with the elite drivers of the world, but it's just not in a place where Ricciardo feels confident and comfortable. And therefore he's, you know, he hasn't suddenly become a bad driver. He's just not able to access his best performance the way that car operates. Just in the same way Jenson Button could, if you gave him oversteer, that was it. You know, Andrew Shovlin, I remember doing an interview with him about Jenson, and he said, you know, that's what you'd always work on every weekend. You know, if the rear end was too nervous, you'd try to dial that back, and then Jenson would be comfortable, and then Jenson could, you know, on his day, he could beat everybody. But if you didn't give him that characteristic, or he felt, you know, that the car was too nervous, he wouldn't be able to access 100%. And if I feel like it's similar with Ricciardo, you know, whereas Norris, you know, it's no shame to say that, you know, Norris is just able to be a bit more adaptable, like a lot of the younger guys are. You know, that's what makes Norris an elite driver, and why McLaren have re-signed him to a mega long contract, because they've finally seen, you know, this is a guy who can drive the wheels off anything, basically. You know, he may not be quite so outwardly aggressive and as big a personality as someone like Max or even Charles, but, you know, he can do the job. And I think I'm pretty convinced Russell's the same. You know, we're seeing a little bit of that now at Mercedes. You know, the car's obviously really challenging, and that, I think Lewis is on a bit of a come down from, you know, not being in championship contention and, you know, being used to a bit more grip than he's now got available. I mean, Vettel had the same problem, didn't he, against Ricciardo at Red Bull. You know, for Daniel, he went into probably the worst Red Bull ever at that point. Well, certainly since they'd started being a winning team. And for him, it was a step up from Toro Rosso regardless, whereas for Vettel, it was a huge come down, and it takes some adjustment, I think, for any driver. But nevertheless, as challenging as that is for Lewis, Russell is showing that he's, you know, he's an elite driver, isn't he? Because he's making the absolute best of that terrible situation. So,
whereas Daniel's learning via the medium of quotes broadcast to him that he's fallen out of favour.
Yeah. Well, that's a proper hurry up, isn't it? Those Zac Brown quotes saying there are mechanisms. You don't really want to be hearing that about the mechanism in the contract that say there might be an early end. You know, that's
like something
to pull your finger out.
It's like something a mafia boss would say: we have mechanisms to move you on.
We have ways of making you talk.
I mean, when you reflect on the highs, and, well, he's had a couple of lows at Monaco, but when you think of the highs that Daniel has had at Monaco, and then you look back at that weekend, and to your point, Ben, you know, you see him drive the car into the swimming pool section, and he has an expectation of grip levels and, you know, turning and braking and performing. He has an expectation of what's going to be there, and it's not there, and he ends up having a really embarrassing shunt. You know, that must have hurt in so many ways. And then Zach's comments in the media, it's a very difficult moment. And, you know, I know we're going to move on to other topics, but again, looking at all of these things, I have to say there aren't many managers of drivers who who cover all bases. And obviously with a manager, you want commercial negotiation when your contract comes up. But it's also helpful to have a manager who can help you with the internal, you know, team situation, to talk to the team principal, technical director, support you, make sure you get what you need, because not every driver can fight all of their battles internally within the team. So you need a structure around you to help you to do that. Lando Norris's manager is effectively his father. And, you know, you have the impression of a very settled relationship there at McLaren. And to your point, actually, around Lando...
Well, he's got Zach as well, hasn't he?
And he's got Zach.
Zach is a massive Lando ally.
Fan, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, and a fan. Yeah, brought him into the team when he was still a junior racer, you know, got him on the simulator program. Like, they've been, you know, for want of a better word, grooming Lando for success at that team for many years. So I think that's maybe an element that the Ricciardo camp underappreciated, like how ingrained Norris has been in that team even before he made his F1 debut.
Yeah. Absolutely correct. That's exactly right. And I think you look at Lando, he's come in as the young, smiley, slightly giggly, you know, social media popular young...
Gaming nerd.
gaming nerd, you know. Here, some of those very smooth edges have now been roughened. You know, he's becoming a tougher competitor. Add another year or two of that onto him. He's... You know, by the time he's in his mid-20s, he's probably going to be... I mean, he's already a formidable competitor. I mean, he has, exactly as you say, he has the potential to be one of the giants of, you know, Formula One over the next decade.
Despite being so diminutive in stature.
Despite being so diminutive, yeah. But, you know, and again, looking at the bigger picture for Formula One into the future, you know, 2026, once the... Volkswagen, Audi, you know, Audi, Porsche entry into Formula One happens, there's going to be some pretty formidable opportunities for more talent to get into cars and teams which have the resource and the focus to win championships. And so for the Landos and the Georges of this world, along with Max and Charles, there's going to be some pretty bright opportunities for them in the future, and they are the players. And this is, again, a really interesting topic around the number two driver. I almost sometimes feel there would be less pressure on them if the teams just said, we've signed a lead driver and a support driver. You know, Sergio Perez is the support driver at Red Bull Racing, because then when he wins a Grand Prix, it would be seen for what it is, which is going above and beyond the role of support. Actually, they have the ability in them to win. But of course, you know, drivers don't want to be known as a number two or a support driver. They all want to... Everyone always says we have equal status. And we all know it's complete nonsense. There isn't equal status, because they sit in a debrief twice a day and they look at the data, and the data very often shows that there is not equal status, because one driver is just... I mean, this is... You know, Valtteri will now say, you know, that you sit in so many meetings where, you know, Lewis is just a tenth or two tenths quicker, and you can't find that. And so, you know, once you've done that for, let's say, half a season, and you're 11, 12 races in, and you're just like, wow, I can't match that on a consistent basis. I mean,
well, drivers have this moment. I mean, I think I've spoken on the previous podcast how Bottas did that to Alexander Sims, who was one of the British rising stars of single-seater racing until they were teammates. And, you know, I think Sims was unlucky not to get, you know, more of a sniff of F1, but he almost talked himself out of the game, because he basically said, you know, I'd look at the data that of Valtteri, and I couldn't work out how he was finding the time.
And that's spanked by Bottas.
That's just it's not much. You're talking about tiny fractions, but if you can't see where that is or feel where that is, then that's it. You've reached a ceiling, haven't you? And I think Alexander had that relative to Bottas, and then Bottas eventually had that relative to Hamilton. And what do? You know, you can't keep bashing your head against the brick wall, can you? I think in Ricciardo's case, McLaren perhaps weren't sure. I think that you hedge your bets, don't you? You sign a Grand Prix winner, a proven top driver, and you think your young star has the potential to be that or more, but you don't know it until you see the data. And now they have the data, don't they? And I don't think you're seeing the best of Ricciardo for the reasons mentioned, but I'm not sure... honestly, whether he can match Lando in, you know, in, equal setting. I'm not sure. Like, Lando just seems to be getting better and better and better, as you'd expect. I mean, he's a young guy, isn't he? He's got still got a lot to learn.
Well, word gets about, doesn't it? Because when you sort of are able to circulate around the paddock and speak to people, as is increasingly happening now, you sort of get a bit more of a feel for what's going on, rather than sort of looking at it through a window, so to speak. And so I do feel we're kind of at a tipping moment with that, because, you know, Mark, your column this month, you tackle the question of remote access to the people of the paddock based on your experiences in Australia. And you asked the question, is it possible to service F1 fans with that depth of background knowledge when you're not actually there? And is it possible to hold the truth to account, etc., over a Zoom call? And it has been interesting, certainly for me, to get back into the paddock in Miami and Monaco, where some of the restrictions are being eased a bit, and you are in a situation where you can speak to people. And I'd say, you know, our two big features this month have benefited from being present at a Grand Prix, and one of them wouldn't even have happened. Our Miami travelogue wouldn't have happened if there was no travelling to Miami. But there's also speaking directly to Heavy Pohjola about Max and Charles. He's the only guy who's worked with both of them, and we would have been tricky to rig up a Zoom call. As it happens, Alpha very kindly facilitated 15 minutes sit down with him in their hospitality, in a brief moment where it wasn't full of freeloaders.
I was quite taken aback with my experience in Melbourne, because, as I said in the column, it packed grandstands. The paddock itself was buzzing. There was lots of people in the paddock, lots of corporate, you know, guests, sponsors, and there was such a really positive atmosphere around that Australian Grand Prix. You know, people talk about a 2-year gap. It's been a 3-year gap. 2019 was the last time they had a Grand Prix. 2022, the response of people there was just sheer joy at Formula One coming back, and of course, as Australia's also coming out of its challenging COVID times, there was a real sense of, yes, we're all back here, having the opportunity to meet each other face to face, enjoy world class sport, you know, see the best in Grand Prix racing. And then to walk into a media centre, which, I mean, I am not joking, was 85% empty. There was almost no one there. Tumbleweed. And then to begin to realise, just from having conversations, when I mentioned in the column Joe Sayward, who, you know, I've known for a very long time, and he's, you know, a Formula One media stalwart and has been to all the Grand Prix through the COVID pandemic. And he sat and chatted to me for a while about some of their experiences. I think he said to me in Russia there were nine international media turned up. And so I was kind of reflecting on that. And then I was also looking at, you know, how the press conferences are handled, you know, the people streaming, you know, being streamed to journalists who were then asking questions down the line and all that kind of thing. And then as I walked through the paddock, I noticed a couple of these sort of media huddles where, you know, the driver sit at a table, there's a press officer, and, you know, the journalists sit round and they all put their recorder in front of the drivers. And again, I was reflecting on the changed times. I mean, in some ways it's super efficient. It means that a large group of journalists can all get a soundbite from the driver, albeit they're all getting exactly the same one, so there's certainly no possibility of getting an exclusive. They're all getting the same quotes provided to them. And then furthermore, kind of reflecting on my own experience, because I spent a few years as a what do they call it? There's a particular name. It's not pundit, but anyway, working for BBC Five Live. So just, you know, helping
the expert commentator.
Well, actually, it's not expert commentator. It'll come to me, perhaps, hopefully. Maybe not during this podcast. Maybe I'll remember in about a week's time. But anyway, just kind of making, you know, I'm there supporting the commentators. And for reasons
of budget, you're known as the talent, aren't you, Mark?
for reasons of budget, you know, the BBC had made a decision, and the production company, to start broadcasting the races remotely. And I felt that was And I know that that used to happen in the old days with Murray Walker and James Hunt. They would very often broadcast Grand Prix from London. You know, just they'd be calling the race down the line from a remote facility. So it's not like this is new. But I have a kind of a view, and it is perhaps an old-fashioned view, that there's nothing like being on site, because it's very difficult to bring to fans the sense of occasion and the off-the-record conversations and little snippets from, you know, meeting a driver in the car park, or, you know, at breakfast in a hotel or in a, you know, being able to say to fans, oh, last night such and such was telling me this or whatever. So you start to lose all of that. So everyone's kind of reporting the same things. And I suppose really that experience in Melbourne triggered my thought for the column, because kind of, If we zoom out a bit and say, well, excuse the pun,
zoom out.
If we zoom out a bit and look at the big picture, you know, the post-COVID world of business and work is completely different for everyone. I mean, we're seeing that in so many different roles, so many different jobs. I do hope that most of the Formula One media, most of the time, do get to go to most of the races. I think that's really quite important. And I think and it's also been interesting, even in Monaco, to, you know, there was a moment in Monaco where I realised that quite a well-known driver who is, you know, broadcasting in Formula One doesn't actually go into the paddock, doesn't go into the races because he's not vaccinated and therefore isn't allowed to. And I thought, well, actually, this explains a lot. But the reality is that you cannot possibly be adding significantly to the content if you're not actually there at any point. And it's really important to have that. And, you know, Cotters, to your experience of being in Miami and Monaco and, you know, being able to trigger those features that you've been able to write, go and have a proper face-to-face conversation with someone, really adds significantly to it all. So I think my point is that it becomes quite easy for teams and for Formula One to allow the media to be pushed away and to say, well, you know, we don't need to have a face-to-face interview. We don't need to do anything other than just send you all the same quotes down the line. We don't need to provide any special access to you. But actually, it's important that the media are given the opportunity to interrogate people at any level, and to you know, it's freedom of the press and all that good stuff. But and I know it's only Formula One, but nevertheless, it's important that I think the media have the opportunity to give fans deep insight and to build relationships. And actually, I think it also works in the other direction. I think that, you know, if the teams want to improve the way in which they are talked about on social media, if the teams want to improve the way they're talked about by the media following the sport, it's important that the teams themselves build strong face-to-face relationships with, you know, the media and the journalists that cover them. And the same applies for the drivers. And I think, you know, quite often now when I see a narrative around a particular driver, we just talked about Daniel, you know, how many journalists get the chance to sit down and have a private chat with Daniel over a coffee and say, listen, mate, what's really happening? And he can say, well, you know, gosh, I'm having a nightmare. Like, I can't say that on the record, but here's what's happening. That becomes quite useful because it helps his case, because the media, you know, that journalist can then take away, respect the fact that it's off the record, but definitely sort of feed the angle in. That becomes really important. And, you know, I said in my column, I mean, I used the example of Murray Walker. You know, he used to kind of, on a morning, he would just walk down motorhome to motorhome, pop in, have a coffee, have a chat to people. And, you know, by 11 or 12 o'clock, you know, a couple of hours before the races started, Murray didn't need to go and read all the press releases. He had had a chat with the technical director at Team A, the team principal at Team B, the race engineer at Team C. He'd been stopped by a driver, you know, and had a chat in the paddock. So I know times have changed, but I feel that post-COVID, you know, it's important that given the growth of the sport, given the expanding fan base that the sport's been enjoying off the back of all of Liberty's efforts and Netflix and Drive to Survive, etc., it's important that that fan base are well served by the media who follow Formula One, that they're provided with those insights. And as I say, I do think it's a two-way street. I think it's also important for the teams and drivers that they build those relationships, and we don't lose that personal connection and personal insight that can be given through strong relationships.
I think that will come back. You know, I think we're just in the hangover phase, aren't we, where the pandemic has receded to some extent, but not fully. And the FIA is, you know, quite naturally, as a regulator and enforcer of safety, being quite cautious. And I think while restrictions remain in terms of how you travel or even access the paddock, there's a certain sense of responsibility to facilitate access for people who can't meet those criteria for whatever reason. And also, it's, you know, it's very expensive to cover Formula One full time. And, you know, one of the consequences of the pandemic is businesses are struggling. That persists, and therefore, you know, people can't actually afford to travel to the races in the same way. I think it's interesting you mentioned Australia, you know, obviously because you went on behalf of us. Thank you very much. But, you know, I remember the times when I was traveling to every race and I went to the Australian Grand Prix. It was never one of the most packed media centres, even though it was the first race of the season, because it's just so far away for most of the Formula One following media. Therefore, it's the most expensive race to go to. And therefore, if you've got a limited budget and you have to say, right, I'm going to prioritise 12 out of 20 races or 14 out of 20 races, which I think used to be the FIA minimum for, you know, retaining a full-time pass, you know, that might be one that you just forego because it's going to be always one of the most expensive races to attend. And I think the pandemic just kind of, like many things, it just kind of turbocharges a trend that's already present. And it'll be interesting to see how things change as we slowly claw our way out. I imagine we'll go back to largely what you advocate, which is, you know, the slightly older way of doing things. I think the personal, you know, being able to touch it, feel it, being on the ground, that's really, really important, vital to you know, to successful Formula One journalism. But some of the remote ways of working have been quite useful. I know Ferrari found it quite useful to be able to host certain events online, corporate ones, also some driver interviews. And I remember doing an interview with Carlos Sainz for a cover feature last year where he chatted to me for half an hour or more over Zoom or whichever other, you know, remote access platforms are available, as we know, from a Maranello office. And it was great. You know, he was very relaxed. You know, he was out of, because sometimes you have the problem of trying to conduct these interviews or conferences over the race weekend where there's so much else going on and the drivers are, you know, their headspace is filled with all sorts of things, you know, besides the core thing of doing their job, trying to go quickly and improve the car and themselves. But being able to talk to them remotely, yes, but away from the pressure of the race weekend, actually can be more useful because they're in a different frame of mind, they're more relaxed, and you have a better conversation than you would if you're trying to grab 15 minutes or even the same half an hour slot in the middle of a packed race weekend programme. And I felt something similar when I interviewed Robert Kubica. You know, he, yes, it was still a race weekend, but because he didn't have to be in the car, he was in quite the same headspace. So he was, again, much more relaxed. You know, you still had, even though it was over a screen, he still gave a very good interview. So perhaps, you know, ultimately we're back to the way things are right now for a lot of people. It's a hybrid solution maybe that points the way forward short term. I still agree with you ultimately that, you know, however you feel, it's important to have a presence in the paddock. You know, if you're going to do a serious, credible job of lifting the lid on Formula One for fans.
Yeah. It's interesting also what you're saying there about your experience of interviewing Carlos Sainz, because I did an online event with Valtteri Bottas back in just at the tail end of last year. And he was amazing. But he was online, you know, chatting to a client of mine. And he obviously was able to do it from home. Which meant it was, you know, instead of having to do a personal appearance by flying somewhere, of staying in a hotel, being picked up, running back and forward to an airport, you know, able to do it online. And he really enjoyed it because it wasn't a big chunk out of his day. It was, you know, 45 minutes or whatever.
It's efficient, isn't it? You use the word
incredibly,
efficiency. And that is important to remember. You know, we're trying to, Formula One also, it has this, you know, we've mentioned it before and you've written about it extensively, Mark. There's a big environmental consideration for Formula One now, you know, about how it conducts its business, how it makes savings, how it doesn't waste resources. And this kind of way of working is a big tick in the plus column for efficiency and, you know, carbon footprint. So it's not to be dismissed, as much as, you know, people like to go back to what's familiar.
And I mean, I even wonder if there is a, you know, and I'm sorry, guys, if I'm breaking any eggshells here, and given that it's your full-time role in, you know, working in the media, but I even wonder in the long term whether there's an opportunity for media to work with freelancers in regions where journalists attend the Grand Prix that are in their region. So, there are some really capable journalists in Australia who do not cover Formula One because they can't fly to all the races, but they were at the Australian Grand Prix. They would have a huge enthusiasm for, you know, interviewing an F1 driver or, you know, producing a really good feature. And again, thinking about the environmental considerations of global travel, you know, I do wonder if in the long term you will have global media companies have, you know, freelancers who they can turn to in the Americas, you know, North America, Latin America, Asia Pacific, the Gulf. You know, if you had a journalist in the Gulf who just went to the Gulf races, they would currently be going to four of those events. You know, and I wonder if that's also part of what might happen in the long term, so that the hybrid model applies not just in how you get the content delivered, but who you work with, you know, in terms of that dynamic of how, and obviously that then also diversifies the base of media who are feeding into, you know, the Formula One, the feeding content into Formula One. So it's just interesting. And I think, you know, I used to do all the Grand Prix every season, you know, but I mean, admittedly, through the late 80s, 90s, 2000s, Formula One was still quite a Eurocentric championship. You know, we had a number of long-haul races, you know, four or five long-haul races in the season, but they were, you know, it was the exception. Obviously, things have pivoted, and you now have an environment in which, you know, a Martin Brundle will not want to go to all 23 Grand Prix. People have asked me this year a couple of times, oh, why wasn't Martin commentating for Sky Sports at a particular race? You know, Martin doesn't want to attend all 23, you know, Grand Prix, so he's still going to do the vast majority of them. I know David Coulthard also, you know, for Channel 4, he doesn't want to be at every single Grand Prix. So, and that's understandable. The championship calendar has expanded, so not only is it extremely expensive to do all the Grand Prix, actually, from just a you know, I think a health and well-being point of view, it's not desirable to do all the Grand Prix. But, you know, it's good to hear, Ben, that you think it will come back. I do think that it is very much going to be a hybrid model. It's going to be a combination of, you know, streaming content, being at certain events, having that face-to-face opportunity. But I just don't want Formula One to lose that personal connection that exists between key media and the teams and drivers, so that fans get the authentic, genuine insight that really they deserve, and that I know the media, you know, guys like you want to bring to them.
Well, I hope so, because otherwise we won't have jobs.
Rather basic.
I'll be scanning the online classifieds if things don't go the right way.
The great thing about people like the late Murray Walker was that they could take anything and turn it into entertainment. I remember Morris Hamilton telling me a sort of amusing anecdote of being just as a favour to the particular PR guy, dragging himself to some press conference by a new clutch supplier or something like that. And Murray was there perfectly happily. Morris thinking, oh God, do I have to? And at the end of this sort of this presentation, Murray went, well, that was fascinating, and he was able to sort of extract the magic from it and presumably dropped it into a broadcast somewhere or other, and it was helpful and it was interesting, and all sorts of things like that eventuated. I'm sure our listeners can look up on YouTube that famous Monaco Grand Prix where Murray is relating, I believe it's René Arnoux's excuse for being slow in the Ligier, and he's obviously gone and spoken to René about it and found out, you know, quite why he's so slow. Let's just say that James Hunt isn't buying that excuse. Using a phrase that presumably didn't go down too well during daytime TV.
As it BBC Television Centre, yeah, people having heart attacks while...
There'd have been complaints. This was before the day when people used to say that the BBC was Marxist. Anyway, we have gone well over our hour, so it is time for me to say thank you to my guest. Mark, you've got to jump on a hopefully uncancelled plane to... Is it Sweden?
Yes, I'm off to sunny Gothenburg today. And then spending the weekend down in Helsingborg, where I'm taking the ferry across to Denmark to visit the castle, which was the inspiration for Hamlet.
Ah, marvellous.
Elsinore Castle. Yeah.
There was someone, there was a thespian on the BBC's Who Do You Think You Are programme who had... dim and distant relatives who hailed from that part of the world, and she was over the moon about it.
Yeah, it wasn't Dame Judi Dench, was it?
It might have been Dame.
Yeah,
Judi
I think
Dench.
She discovered that in her distant past she was a descendant of Shakespearean actors from, you know, back in the days, which was so. Anyway, so that's this week. A little bit of work during the week, and then. Long weekend driving around Sweden and enjoying whatever I find.
That's obvious. Obviously, Ben Anderson has Zoom calls with our higher ups to contend with,
and a magazine to make.
In the absence of our managing editor, who has left us to go up to Scotland for a week, so
bedlam.
Bedlam ensued. I had to organise the Teams call yesterday, and for a moment, I thought it hadn't worked, and I'd only invited myself. So,
then you couldn't shut it down.
The meeting was still running with no one in it. Who knew it worked like that? Anyway, so the return of Wiggy to the office on Monday is, to use a Shakespearean phrase, a consummation devoutly to be wished. The current.
Well, I'm going to be on holiday, and I'm glad I'm going to be missing Monday's meeting, because it sounds like something I don't want to be a part of. But you and Wiggy consume away.
They can consummate themselves on their Monday morning editorial.
I know you miss him, Connors, but I didn't realise it was so deep.
Neither did he.
It says on my notes that the July edition prints on Wednesday, June the 22nd, so the next edition will be on sale Thursday, June the 7th. Wait, hold on a minute. No.
June 30th, got us.
June the 30th. That's because Wiggy forgot to update the thing in the flat plan. So, yes, June the 30th. Thursday, June the 30th. We've passed June the 2nd. That was last week. That was when this issue came out. I'll tell you what, working on a monthly on remote, there's an element of time travel. Anyway, don't forget to visit gpracing.com for all the latest subscriber offers. Thank you for listening, and thank you to our producer, as ever, Martin Lee.